Great. Well, Andrew told us that a republic cannot survive if the means for registering popular consent cannot be trusted. And he asked us if we can rely upon our elections as legitimate, fair opportunities to make the changes they seek, the changes we seek. He further said that we should focus on the present and the future, and I am very bad at following directions, so I'd like to go back a few hundred years. Beginning with the election of Zachary Taylor in 1848, the presidential election began to be held on a single day nationwide. By law, all voters were to decide together who would lead the country for the next 4 years on the Tuesday after the first Monday in November. The change to a single day of voting occurred out of concern for election integrity. The 1844 election, which had been spread out for more than a month, was rife with fraud and practices that put the election's legitimacy into question. Voters also feared that election outcomes in states with earlier election dates were influencing how later states voted. So we moved to one day. But by 2020, the practice of Americans voting on the same day had become a thing of the past. Hold on. Okay, sorry. And Americans had returned to what had been rejected in the 1840s, a lengthy window of time to conduct elections. That's not to say that there had not been exceptions for people who needed them prior to 1844. States had long permitted limited absentee voting for select citizens who could present legitimate reasons for why they were unable to go to the polls, such as military deployment. But beginning in the late 1970s, restrictions were seriously loosened. California was the first to allow no excuse absentee balloting, and then states across the country soon followed suit. And now, the country has a months-long voting season. And that was true before 2020, when reforms seriously increased the length of time during which Americans could cast ballots to ludicrous proportions. North Carolinians, for example, could vote in the 2020 election before Labor Day, a full 2 months before Election Day, and nearly a month before the two candidates had met for the first debate. In Virginia right now, I think we started voting yesterday. The changes also obscured the deadline by which votes needed to be counted, a fixture of the system before 2020. Now people wait days, weeks, and sometimes months to find the outcome of elections. In 2016, absentee and mail-in ballots accounted for roughly 33 million of the 140 million ballots counted. In 2020, more than 100 million of the 159 million ballots counted were cast prior to Election Day, including by early voting. The change was enough for former Attorney General William Barr to sound the alarm about how widespread early absentee and mail-in voting was negatively affecting the voting public. Extending voting well beyond voting day, he said, is like telling a jury in a two-month trial that they can vote at any time they want during the trial. I got to interview him for my book, and he was telling me that you can't say it's really a national consensus because people are all operating on a different set of facts. The 2020 election also saw an even more important 19th century electoral reform put on the chopping block. And that was the move to the secret ballot that occurred in the late 1800s. So during the colonial period, there were many methods of voting, from using different colored beans or corn to cast votes, or viva voces, voice votes. In the latter system, each voter's name was called, and the voter was asked publicly before a judge, clerks, the candidates, and other voters whom he was voting for. The practice was abandoned in part because creditors would make their debtors vote for their preferred candidates, taking advantage of the public nature of the polls to ensure that debtors did their bidding. But as a rule, colonies moved to paper ballots early on. Governor John Winthrop, one of the leading figures in founding the Massachusetts Bay Colony, abolished public voting in 1634. By 1706, Pennsylvania had passed a law requiring the use of paper ballots, with provisions given for the illiterate. And by the end of the Revolutionary War, everyone had moved to paper ballots. Voting on paper used to mean remembering candidates' names and writing them down. But as the size and scope of government grew, as Henry was noting, so did the number of elected officials, and well-funded political parties began to print ballots with the names of their preferred candidates already on them. Political parties would give their pre-printed ballots a distinctive design. Democrats in 19th century Charleston, for example, printed red checked backs on their tickets. In Orangeburg County, South Carolina, Republicans made the backs of their tickets look like a playing card. Privacy critics warned that this opened the door once again to bribery and intimidation, as voters could be bullied into carrying into the voting area a recognizable ballot into the voting booth and making sure that they came out without it. To limit voter intimidation, some states required that ballots be printed on white paper without any distinguishing marks, guidelines that were easily flouted. In 1851, Free Soilers and Democrats passed a law requiring that votes be deposited in the ballot box in a sealed envelope. The envelopes were to be of the same size, color, and quality, and to be furnished by the Secretary of State to the town clerks, who would be stationed in the same room as the ballot box. Opponents of the law were later able to make it optional, which mostly meant that those who could be bribed would again continue to be bribed. Bribery and intimidation were such big issues that the 46th Congress of 1879 to 1881 issued a report detailing some of the problems that plagued our insecure voting systems. The report found that employees might be taken to the polls by their employer and compelled to show their ballots before they were cast. This was a particular problem, a particularly pronounced problem, I should say, in northeastern cities and industrial centers, some of the same places where we have problem with election integrity to this day. With political parties printing up the ballots that were to be used, coercion, intimidation, and outright fraud became common complaints. The purchasing of votes in exchange for liquor or money was common, and buying votes wasn't even a federal offense until 1925. Following a model originally developed in Australia, cities and states began to print official ballots that voters could take and cast in a secure environment. This made buying votes much more difficult, as there was no proof of how one had voted. In 1888, the first Australian ballot was used in Louisville, Kentucky. Clear rules were issued for how to get a candidate's name on the ballot. Massachusetts and New York used the system the same year. The practice spread across the country, and South Carolina became the last to adopt the Australian ballot in 1950. And states took the cost up of printing the ballots. Party machines and other interested parties didn't like the new system because it made it almost impossible to know whether attempted bribery had been successful or not. And verifiable instances of fraud plummeted. Many other practices were adopted to limit voter fraud and intimidation. States and municipalities began to keep voter rolls to limit precinct hopping and double voting. Privacy curtains were added to voting areas. Judges and observers from opposing parties were brought in to observe the casting of ballots to limit fraud from corrupt election commissions. The reforms greatly decreased the tumult of elections and increased public confidence in election results. As election rules across the country were gradually reformed to address corruption, the franchise was also expanded. For more than a century then, for nearly all, so women, minorities, everyone gets it expanded. For more than a century then, for nearly all voting Americans, election day meant going into a voting place and identifying oneself to a poll worker. You voted privately, perhaps behind a curtain with no one else to see how you voted. The move to early and mail-in voting took away some of that secrecy, along with the ability to detect fraud or coercion. Deviations from in-person election day voting are supposed to replicate the security and anti-fraud protocols a city or state has for in-person voting on election day. You know, ideally, early voting is basically just like voting on election day, just earlier. You go to a public place, you identify yourself, your name is checked off the rolls, you receive a ballot, you fill it out in secret, you cast the ballot into a locked box that will be counted on election day. Early voting hinges on public trust in election officials who take custody of ballots. You voters have to trust that election officials aren't playing games with the ballots in the weeks before election day or otherwise letting ballots be tampered with. Mail-in balloting varies widely from state to state. From an election integrity standpoint, once again, you're supposed to try to kind of emulate what happens in person. You may fill out the ballot at your kitchen table, but you're supposed to attest that you did it without coercion. You're supposed to sign to say that it really was your ballot. A signature is supposed to match a signature that's on file. You know, some states provide secrecy envelopes to kind of help you vote secretly and not under coercion from a family member or employer. So this is where there are many deviations from our system with the mail-in ballot. Prior to the 2020 election, the media and other partisans admitted that fact freely, that mail-in balloting was open to fraud. You know, France banned mail-in voting in 1975 because of how it was an easy opportunity for fraud. The 2005 Commission on Federal Election Reform, chaired by former President Jimmy Carter and former Secretary of State James Baker, declared that absentee ballots remain the largest source of potential voter fraud. The bipartisan commission was formed to address voting and election integrity issues following the razor-thin 2000 presidential election, which was adjudicated, of course, at the Supreme Court. Of particular concern was how vulnerable voters might be coerced to vote in a way that more powerful people told them to. As they said, citizens who vote at home, at nursing homes, at the workplace, or in church are more susceptible to pressure, overt or subtle, or to intimidations. Vote buying schemes are far more difficult to detect when citizens vote by mail, the report said. A 2000 report by Caltech and MIT's Voting Technology Project concluded that the greatest fraud problems lie in absentee balloting and recommended that states restrict or abolish on-demand absentee voting in favor of in-person early voting. Further, the report stated that there is no evidence that liberalizing absentee voting laws or enacting early or vote-by-mail schemes has increased voter turnout dramatically, except under one condition, which is when the laws are sufficiently ambiguous or liberal to allow partisan forces to use them to boost the turnout of party loyalists. I will note at this point that in the most recent election, we had a $419 million campaign funded by Mark Zuckerberg, one of the world's wealthiest and most powerful men, in which he funneled money to two very left-wing organizations to overtake government election operations, handling everything from voter registration to ballot curing and everything in between. So precisely the issue, the one exception under which they said that you could affect the election. Not that long ago, the notion that mail-in ballots were problematic was the accepted wisdom in liberal media outlets. The New York Times said, voting by mail is now common enough and problematic enough that election experts say there have been multiple elections in which no one can say with confidence which candidate was the deserved winner. That was Adam Liptak in 2012. In an article headlined, Error and Fraud at Issue as Absentee Voting Rises. And then David Ferentold at the Washington Post said, absentee ballots are not the only way to fraudulently win an election, and said that selling votes was a common type of election fraud. I kind of want to leave at this point to go and respond to some of what Henry said, but I want to kind of conclude my remarks here, but also just there's one little additional thing, which is the question is whether we can trust our elections and whether we can have confidence in them. And the fact is that there is a lot of variation in this country by jurisdiction in how elections are administered. There's also a lengthy history. We have had a history of election security issues. And the question isn't whether they're totally secure now or totally insecure recently, but really where we are on a continuum that we must always fight for. And we should be very mindful of how much work went into single day, in person, secure, secret ballots, and be very wary of not just the, you know, confidence that when you move away from that, that you are having a heavily manipulated election, but just that the gift that is provided by moving to a closer and closer to a single day of secure balloting so that the country can kind of come to a decision, find out what that decision is quickly, and be able to move on in a healthy way. So, thank you.